Oscar Hijuelos is the first Latino to win a Pulitzer Prize for fiction for his novel The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. The book gives you the sense of someone living deeply inside two cultures and languages. But what happens when language leaves us? That's what happened to Oscar Hijuelos, whose latest book is a memoir called Thoughts Without Cigarettes. It tells the story of how Hijuelos got sick on a visit to Cuba as a child. After a year in a home for terminally ill children, he emerged without his first language, Spanish. Here's Hijuelos reading Steve Paulson a passage from his memoir.
For the longest time, all I would know was that I had gotten sick in Cuba from Cuban microbials, that the illness had blossomed in the land of my forebears, a country where I had once been loved and whose language fell as music on my ears. Of course, diseases happen anywhere and children get sick under any circumstances, but what I would hear for years afterward from my mother was that something Cuban had nearly killed me and, in the process of my healing, would turn my own Cubanness into air.
Now, it turned out that sickness from nephritis when you were very young really changed your life. Can you explain what happened?
Well, I always found it ironic that one of the statements my mother always told me while I was growing up is that, you know, before you went into the hospital, you only spoke Spanish, and when you came out, you spoke English. The irony for me is that I'd been down in Cuba, of course, the fount of the Spanish language and the family emotions and so forth, where I'd apparently contracted that disease. And the irony for me has always been that it was the Cuban experience and being there that led me to a situation in which I'd spent a year in hospitals and a time in which I was separated from not only the culture, the language, but also my family. And I'd always thought of it as the Cuban disease, which turns out to have, you know, I guess it did a number on me in terms of my sense of self and how I felt about the world and life and security issues and who I identified with. I mean, I do recall coming home from the hospital and having only a vague sense of belonging, which is really strange for a young child. And when I'd hear Spanish being spoken, I always understood it, interestingly enough, but I always felt that it was suddenly something outside of myself. And since then came to identify the language with, you know, not only those microbios, but this whole other issues of that it's almost like a dangerous kind of entity because it was part of that world which had messed me up in the first place.
I have to say, though, it's kind of heartbreaking to read this account, especially when you came home. I mean, here was your mother who had, you know, doted on you, still did, and she only knew Spanish. She didn't speak English, and you could understand what she said, but you would talk back to her in English. I mean, this must have been sort of terrible for her.
My mother passed away about 4 or 5 years ago, and she was a handful. All her life, she was always a very complex human being. And as a kid growing up, I mean, it took her years and years to pick up more than just a few English phrases. And as I recall, she had this very tentative relationship to the English language, as if though it was prickly and thorny and, you know, filled with its own kind of bad energies, whereas I was on the other side, sort of forced into that, you know, using that language with her. Our sense of communication was always a bit on the fractured side. Although we did get along, and, you know, while I was writing the book, I tried to go into that zone in which, you know, you actually remember conversations with someone. And, you know, in the instance of my mother, it was always her talking and giving orders and telling me what to do in Spanish.
So maybe this partly explains why you didn't want to learn to speak Spanish. I mean, there was something obstinate about your resistance to speaking Spanish, maybe partly in response to your mother.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, I had some very nice, you know, we had other Latinos, Latinas in our lives who were pretty nice. But, you know, to sort of immerse oneself in a language. You have to sort of live it, you know, live it fully. And for example, my brother, my older brother, Jose, who never had went through that separation anxiety and all the, you know, all that business, grew up speaking what he'd heard in the household, which was a Cuban Spanish. And yet, you know, over the years, we'd have talks about this, his exposure to the bilingual thing on the streets and the fact that we were mainly educated in English, for example, that, you know, it erodes over time. You have to be living in the heart of the culture to allow the language to become a part of your life fully.
Well, and you say that it went beyond, I mean, the impact of all of this went beyond just not speaking Spanish. And you write at one point, when it came to the culture you came from, you would always remain an outsider looking in.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I had kind of a double whammy on me because, first of all, I've always been extremely nearsighted all my life. And I've been told by doctors since that it had to do with what I... nephritis. My father never wore glasses, unless, you know, maybe in a pinch, you know, and later, much later in his life. My mother never did. I mean, she was 94. She never had to wear glasses. And neither did my brother until recently. And he's, you know, a bit on over 60 and all that. But also, I was very fair and blonde. And it was almost ironic. I mean, another way I would look at it is, okay, you were torn away from your culture and because you went to Cuba, which is the fount of your culture, but something happened there that sort of separated you and always made you even more different than other Cubans. And on top of that, I'm not claiming that I'm the only blonde, fair-skinned Cuban who came onto the earth, but I'm the only one I knew of, you know, when I was growing up. So I felt rather out of place, even on a different level. I mean, it was sort of like I didn't look Cuban, and also I didn't particularly relate intellectually or emotionally in terms of the language. And the funny thing is that, you know, I don't know how current generations take these issues of race and ethnic identity. I mean, I've seen younger kids who seem to take everything for granted. But in my day, I mean, there was real prejudice. And, you know, I remember being growing up and, you know, looking so white, I'd get, you know, chased down by Latinos who did not know me, you know, as whitey. And then I'd be around white folks who didn't know I was Latino, who'd be like talking about spick this and spick that. And you know, I sort of got, you know, both the negative from both ends.
Well, and of course, you're famous for your novels about the Cuban immigrant experience. So I guess the question is, when did you rediscover your Cuban roots?
You know, I think they were always there. I mean, the archetypal scene I've always had in my mind was always my father in the kitchen hanging out with his chums, not necessarily always Cuban. One of his best friends was a Mexican superintendent named Daniel Martinez. And another guy I've only always known as Frankie the Exterminator, you know. and there was just something intensely, I mean, years later when I'd go to Spain or countries like Portugal, and I'd go into these little bars and I'd see these scenes played out in corner tables between these very intensely focused guys drinking and smoking and talking about life and wondering what it's all about. That was always an archetypal kind of scene in my head. And so that sort of drifts into my novels. But I'll tell you, one of the first times I really, it has something to do, I think I was with my older brother and I was in my 20s, and we went down to an event that was held in, I believe it was at the 84th Street movie theater before it became this giant, you know, multiplex or whatever. And it was a performance of Alicia Alonso's ballet company, National Ballet Company of Cuba. And you walked in there, and there were anti-Castro Cubans in the joint, and there were pro-Castro Cubans, of course, and you could feel the tension in the room. But, you know, as soon as Alicia Alonso walked on stage, and there's something emotionally happened in that room in which he just felt like crying. So, to be Cuban is so beautiful. And, you know, it's that kind of moment that catches you unaware that will occur at any number of occasions. That's just a more overt one. But I just, like, bump into someone and say, hey, it is Cubano, you know, and I say, yeah, you know, I grew up in New York. And then you start chatting, and then you just feel this kind of, like, emotional warmth that you don't—I mean, I guess every ethnicity has that connection and pride. But for me, it was something that I only recovered slowly through these intimate moments with people or on occasion.
How is your Spanish now?
My running joke is, depending on how many cups of wine and I've had. You know, it depends if I'm around. So I've done interviews in Spanish, and I always feel a little awkward about me. Acento muy americano, you know, and all that. But, you know, if someone's really warm and nice to me, I loosen up, and I don't feel any this tension, you know. On the other hand, I was in Miami once, and I'm hanging out the Tango dance parlor in this hotel called the Biltmore. Ironically, that's the name of the hotel my father worked for in New York. And I'm just looking in, and it's a late middle-aged Cuban woman comes out, and of course in a too tight dress and a little, but she couldn't have been warmer. And I said, you know, I said, so hijo de cubanos, you know, I'm a son of Cubans. And she said, oh, come on in, paisano. And you know, it was like, welcome back, you know? Mm. And then on the other hand, I'll be speaking with some guy in an airport, and it turned out he was a dermatologist who was a Cuban, and, you know, he heard my, say, you got a gringo accent, man, for a Cuban, you know? And that's when I just shut down, man. I said, thanks a lot, buddy.
Oscar Hijuelos is the author of the memoir Thoughts Without Cigarettes. He is the first Latino to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction for his novel The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we've used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Living the Language, number 73A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Today's show was engineered by Steve Gotcher. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio.